So, welcome to the late session of VMworld. Hope everybody's able to pay attention and not think about the party later. My name is Jay Judkowitz. I'm a product manager here at VMware. I'm responsible for disaster recovery and as well as VMFS. And what we're here to talk about today is disaster recovery and how VI3 makes that better. There's two parts to the agenda that we're going to talk about. First, we're going to cover, I'm not going to call it a sales pitch, a little more technical than that, but I've got it down to four slides. Four slides talking about why VI3 is important for disaster recovery. And after that, we're going to dive down into some of the best practice stuff based on, there's got a lot of echo going on, isn't there? So we're going to talk about best practices based on deployment type, you know, what type of customer you are, based on what type of application, whether you're going physical to virtual or virtual to virtual. Talk a little bit about networks and a couple of assorted topics. So, jumping right into it. Why is VMware great for disaster recovery? So, we'll go as far as to say that we think, at VMware, we think that the safest place for your application from a disaster recovery perspective is a VMware virtual machine. We think if you put your application on a physical system or on a computing VM, it's just not as safe. And we're going to go over some of the properties why. There's six properties I want to discuss, and then we'll wrap up and go into the best practices. First one is encapsulation. Pretty much everybody's probably seen a VMware sales slide about what encapsulation is, right? All your virtual machines are made up of just a group of files, just a handful of files, which can be transferred as simply as any other files that you might transfer, like music or Word documents or anything. The operating system installation, patches, security, fixes, application installation, application data, configuration, BIOS, all of it is just a handful of files that can be very easily moved. Now, the reason that that's relevant is hardware independence. You can take a rack server in your production site, you know, transfer virtual machines to Blade server on a disaster site, and it's going to come up immediately. The reason is because the virtual machine's guest operating system is tied to the virtual hardware. It's not tied to the physical hardware. So no matter how different the systems are, as long as they're x86 systems, your VMs are going to boot up without any difficulty. That means no bare metal recovery process. That means no bootstrapping your VMs and trying to reinstall system files, or no complete rebuild to reinstall your application. Just copy the encapsulated files, boot them up. Now, it's one thing for me to get up here and say, hey, hardware independence is great, all your VMs always boot, no problems. You're going to want to try that out, right? You want to do a DR test to make sure that everything I'm telling you is true. Now, where's the problem with DR tests? Well, first, you replicated the virtual disk, but then you boot them up, and you're going to do activity. You're going to write things. It's going to corrupt that image. Or not corrupt it, but it's going to use it. You want that pristine image ready for disaster recovery. Second issue is networks. You don't want to do your DR test traffic on your production network and have two copies of the same VM running at two different sites on the same production network. So VMware has two features to really help you with your tests. The first is a snapshot feature. Anybody who's been using ESX2, they know about redo logs and undoable disk mode. In VI3, it's called snapshots. And what that is instead of just having a base virtual disk, it adds a redo log. And that redo log is where all the writes go. The base virtual disk is read-only. Now, you can do whatever you want in that VM. You can install applications, install data, take test traffic, format the hard drive. It doesn't matter. When you're done with that DR test, power off the VM, discard the snapshot, and you're in that pristine state, ready to go for a real disaster should one occur. Next thing is VLANs and port groups. The important things about this is how do you change a physical machine from one network to another? Well, generally you unplug it and put it in somewhere else. That's kind of an error-prone and very manual process. With virtual machines, what you can do is you can pass multiple VLANs over the same physical Ethernet card to the ESX server. You can then label those port VLANs something intelligent like production DR network, test DR network. And everything, all the VMs are sitting there on the test, on the production VM, sorry, production DR network waiting for disaster. When it's time to do a test before you power it on, you just change the drop down in the virtual network card to test network. And then you boot up the VM, and without mucking with wires or anything like that, it's automatically talking on a different VLAN. And now the traffic is isolated from your production network. So in doing that, you're able to isolate your network and isolate your disk changes and run a very successful disaster recovery test. Another important feature is that virtual machines pretty much always boot from shared storage. With physical machines, some people do boot from SAN or boot from iSCSI, but most people, boot from a local disk. So you can have the most complicated, expensive, wonderful replication system in the world, and it's only going to cover your data usually. So now, when you get to the other side, you have to maintain this other system, with a different system disk, patch here, patch there, so that you keep an up-to-date system image. But with virtual machines, because the system OS disk is sitting there with the application disk and the data disk, it's on the shared storage, and if you use storage replication, everything makes it to the DR site ready to be powered on without any kind of maintenance other than the replication itself. Consolidation is another important feature. Everybody's familiar with server consolidation, right? Run less servers, save more money. That's, it's a great story, and I think a lot of people are probably doing that. But what we don't, in DR, it has a little extra benefit. One, you can go from, you can over-consolidate. You can, say I have 20 hosts here, I'm going to have 15 hosts here, and have a slightly restricted SLA when it comes to a disaster. So if you want, you can just compress those VMs down to less servers. The other thing, and much more importantly, you can put a lot of other VMs there that have nothing to do with DR. Test dev systems, batch systems, and be using those physical machines to be running a whole lot of workloads. And then when a disaster occurs, if it occurs, you can instantly repurpose that system by just powering down the batch systems, powering up the DR workloads. So that instant repurposing of the systems is actually critical for DR perspective. Repurposing physical machines, as you know, is quite a bit more complicated. Last feature I want to talk about is resource pooling. And what this is about is placement. So let's say you have 20 blades on one side and 15 rack servers on another side, and you got all these workloads which are going to be shut down and other things restarted. Where do you put each VM for optimal placement? Are you going to be able to pre-plan every time you add a VM to your DR site, try to figure out where to put it on that DR farm? That's not really any fun, and it's not terribly productive. What you do is you put it in a resource pool. So in the example here on the left, you have 5 VMs on 20 gigahertz resource pool, 4 VMs on 12 gigahertz resource pool, and you don't care where they're running. All you do is say, I want this VM to have a certain guarantee of service. You power it on, and it gets placed exactly where it wants to go. So you still have to do a lot of planning for disaster recovery, but we take this one thing away from you. Placement, not a problem. Just make sure you have enough servers to meet the resource guarantees that you set up ahead. So what do these features add up to? Well, it adds up to, like I said before, virtual machines having a lot of capabilities that make DR a lot easier for you. 63% of our customers we surveyed found that use disaster for disaster recovery. It lowers the recovery time because, again, everything's replicated, system disk, hard data, everything in a hardware-independent manner, you're ready to just boot it up and go. The cost is lower because you can use less hardware than you would otherwise use, and you can leverage those hardware investments during non-disaster times. That saves you on capital. On the operational expense, not having to figure out bare metal recovery is a big operational expense you can just cut and do other useful things with the people that would otherwise be doing that. Less reliability. I talked to a customer Tuesday morning, and it was kind of funny. He was giving me a success story. He said, yeah, I can recover 45 VMs in 3 hours. I was like, wow, that's great. Out of curiosity, how long is it taking on physical? And he said, well, that's a stupid question. I couldn't do it on physical. And I was like, well, I thought maybe he's overstating it a bit. Talked to another customer from the Midwest, and they said that when they did DR tests, they went out to a hoster and restored some tapes, they found that they could recover successfully about 80 to 85% of their systems. The other 15-20% had to be reinstalled. So, they did get up and running, but it took a lot more time because they had to do these rebuilds. With virtual machines, you know they're just going to come up. And that bit of reliability, that insurance policy, is absolutely critical to feeling good about your DR plan. So that's really the introductory part. Just kind of level set everybody on our DR capabilities. Any questions on that before we move into some of the more best practice type information? No one? Okay. So, moving right along. So like I said, there's VM failover in theory, right? This is what, as a marketing employee, I want everybody to think. You have a primary site, you replicate everything to a disaster recovery site, somebody in your executive management upsets the gods, Zeus himself comes down from on high, flings his thunderbolt, and you're gone. But since you were smart enough to put everything in virtual machines, everything's replicated, you just power them on. Life's good. Okay, that's the theory. Now let's kind of move on to real life. In real life, you do things slightly differently based on different application types, different size deployments, different budgets. Now, I've done dozens of interviews in the course of last year as a disaster recovery product manager, and I've kind of bucketed the customer responses to questions that I've asked into three different buckets based on their size. Now, these are generalizations. This is not to say this is how you should do it, but these generalizations are going to inform the recommendations that are going to come next. The first class of customers is enterprise data centers. The enterprise data centers, I find, they're companies with billions of dollars of revenue, tens of thousands of employees, massive budgets. Second bucket, commercial data centers. Our commercial customers are people with hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue, hundreds of thousands of employees. And lastly, small and medium business. So for your enterprise data centers, I find most of them have, while some of them do outsourcing, many of them do have separate disaster recovery sites. They have very stringent recovery policies, minutes or less of data loss, minutes or less of downtime. To achieve this, to have tremendous DR budgets, to have a T3 is the smallest network I've ever seen there, and they have very high tier one storage with the most expensive replication. Their business processes are very rigidly controlled because who can do what, when, and where, because they're regulated either by Sarbanes-Oxley or some industry regulations, and they're not terribly tolerant of overhead for any of this stuff to get their RPO and RTO. Commercial data centers are similar. They're often still in-house, slightly less investment. I generally see a T3 as the average what I see for network connectivity, which is enough for them to do replication with the storage they bought, and the process is somewhat less restrictive. Small and medium business, I find, is almost always outsourced for a couple reasons. One, they don't have a second site, or two, because they're not affording the bandwidth or the replication. Maybe they're running off of local disk still or JBOD. And in terms of process, well, pretty much anything goes. Everybody's got the root password. Have fun. So what is the implications of this? So we're going to talk about each of these three classes of customers, and we're going to talk about them in terms of three things. We're going to talk about replication, we're going to talk about workflow, and we're going to talk about testing. Now, the enterprise customers tend to do, tend to do array-based replication. The good news there is we have support from the array vendors, the most important ones, EMC, Hitachi, HP, IBM, Network Appliance. I'm sure there's others, but these five, they've all documented support to one extent or another for replicating ESX server storage. And we have some recommendations that go along with that. Pretty much everybody I've ever talked to about DR, one of the first questions they ask is RDM or VMFS, what's it going to be? And our answer is VMFS for almost everything. Where you need RDMs is when you have special quiescing on the application that you want to tie into the storage replicated. So when you want to tie your application quiescing to your storage replication. The reason that is because with multiple applications running on the same LUN, they can't all possibly quiesce at the same exact moment, meaning when you do the replication, maybe one of the VMs is quiesced, but all the rest aren't. So for applications that don't need any special handling with replication, put them all on VMFS, you'll be just fine. For that Oracle, SQL Server, and Exchange, where you're running some sort of cluster enabling, application-aware cluster enabler, there you want to consider RDMs. People like consistency groups when they use array-based replication. That's one of the cool features of it. So if you take a multi-tier application and make sure you have rate order consistency across the tiers, make sure that you have a predictable crash-consistent moment, not just from one system, but across all the systems that are important. One of the cool things about VMFS is you kind of get a free consistency group. Any VMs you put on the same VMFS, you're going to have a rate order consistency as that VMFS is replicated to the other side, because it's all on the same LUN, so you don't have to worry about cross-LUN consistency. And one of the other reasons for that is a VMFS question that people ask. People ask, well, what if something's cached in the VM kernel for one VM but not for another VM? Won't that break everything? And the answer is we don't cache in the VM kernel. With VMFS, just like with RDM, the data has to make it to the array before the virtual machine gets an acknowledgement. In this way, we preserve file system semantics inside the guest operating system, and you're ensured crash consistency and consistency groups on your array. One last detail, volume resignaturing. This is something with VI3 that you need to do that you otherwise wouldn't need to, that you didn't need to do with VI2, which is when you're replicating storage from one site to another. If it's a VMFS, the destination ESX servers, the servers that will import that VMFS, make sure you turn on volume resignaturing, because otherwise it's going to reject those VMFSs. If you haven't done that yet, it's not a big deal. You can add that setting at any time. So that's one technical detail that kind of catches people when they first upgrade to VI3. Now, workflows. First thing you want to say about workflow recommendation-wise is, if you're a large enterprise and you're highly regulated, make sure you're taking full advantage of Virtual Center 2's access control lists and the ability to do custom roles. With Virtual Center 1.x, you took whatever roles we gave you, and if you didn't like them, well, that was tough. So we learned from that because customers, kind of shook their heads at us and said that was bad. So now you have dozens of possible permissions, and you can make any combination of those into a custom role, assign those custom roles to a user or group in Active Directory, and this allows you to segregate who can do what. These people can operate on the DR site, these people on the production side, these people for the accounting VMs, these people for the engineering VMs. You want to make sure you make full use of that, because disaster recovery, it tends to be one of those highly audited processes in your environment. Dependencies are another thing you want to think about. While I drew that picture of Zeus and all that, where all the VMs just power on, in reality, you worry about startup order. You worry about what VMs are dependent on what other VMs. You worry about, do I have to do the network first or the storage first? Or when do I change the IP addresses? Or, what does DNS come into all of this? You want to make sure you keep track of all your dependencies, and that's real easy if you've got 5 or 10 VMs. If you've got hundreds or thousands of VMs, it gets much more complicated. If you're a very large enterprise, you may want to consider some third-party tool that keeps track of these sort of things, that keeps track of workflow, keeps track of process. I don't have anyone to recommend on this specifically, but a lot of the enterprise customers I talk to are starting to think about all this. The last recommendation here on workflow, don't worry about placement. Just use DRS, use resource pools, and at least let that dependency be gone. Question? No, I mean, for this particular example, so the question was, do I have recommendations for products that would handle DNS and IP and all that? Or do I have a list of products that do that? No, I don't. And it's actually not exactly what I was thinking about with this. Just even something that keeps track of all the tasks, something that can do scheduling of people and resources is something to consider. But unfortunately, I don't really know of things offhand. I just know that they're out there, and it's kind of an emerging software area that people are starting to consider. I don't know much about it, but I've seen people starting to think about it. In terms of testing, I found that the enterprise customers are testing at least twice a year, and some of the more sadistic CIOs are trying to do surprise tests. Wait till the chief architect is on vacation. Then you know if your DR plan works or not. You know if that operations manual works because they don't have the crutch to lean back on. And then the last thing, the really hardcore people are migrating production work to the DR site. They're actually saying, okay, well, I'm actually going to take transactions. I'm actually going to run my business off the DR site for a week. I don't know if that works in a general purpose situation, but certain applications are very well suited to that. I think that's the ultimate in DR testing. So moving down a notch, what happens when you move from the enterprise, when you move from people with unlimited budgets down to the next tier? What do you start finding? Well, you still find array-based replication in there, but you get a lot of host-based replication. And we work very closely with a lot of the host-based replication providers, Exosoft from CA, DoubleTake, EMC, CLI, Topio, Veritas, volume replicator. And the way you would use this today, array-based replication is very simple. It's underneath the ESX server. We don't know about it. We don't have to think about it. And it's not running on our servers. Now, with the host-based replication, the way it's typically run is you put it in the guest operating system, and you start replicating from inside the guest. And this is great. This works just fine. There's a couple of difficulties. One, it's more overhead than you'd want if it were running underneath the VMs. Two, it's more agents to manage, upgrades and patches and whatnot. And third, that resource management story I gave you where all your DR VMs were powered off, freeing up those systems for other useful work, well, that goes away because you have to have target VMs sitting there taking replication. So some of the more enterprising customers have figured out a way around this. What they'll do is they'll replicate from inside the virtual machine on one side, maybe from 5 or 10 of them, to the same VM on the other side. So that catcher VM, if you will, has the 5 or 10 virtual disks. And so VM1 replicates to disk 1, VM2 replicates to disk 2, so on and so forth. Then you only have one running VM instead of 5 or 10 running VMs at the DR site, saving you some computing and memory resources. At the time of a disaster, you power off the catcher VM, detach those virtual disks, attach them to other VMs, the real VMs that you intend to use those virtual disks, and power them on. Now, this has an advantage in terms of resource utilization, but a disadvantage in terms of complexity. So when you start thinking about how to use host-based replication, you have to do these kind of trade-offs. So what about running on the ESX server, running in the service console? There's a couple replication providers that do run there. Two examples are VisionCore, PhD. There's a European company called Exia that also does this. The difference is that they, while instead of being continuous replication, they're working off of virtual machines redo logs. So it is a discrete replication, a point-in-time copy. They can make those intervals smaller, instead of hours like it was originally, they've got those intervals to be pretty small, but it's still a point-in-time copy and not a continuous replication. And this is much simpler to manage, but it doesn't give you the same recovery point objective that you would have with the ones up top. Now, where this is going is that they're going to converge. You're going to have host-based replication products doing continuous replication from within the VM kernel. Now, the way that's going to happen is these people are going to port their, some people are going to port their products to the VM kernel as a third operating system using our community source initiative. So there's a bunch of companies in that, but two of them are DoubleTake and VisionCore are both in there, where VisionCore is going to try to move from discrete to continuous, and DoubleTake's going to move from the guest OS down into the VM kernel and kind of converge around the same place, giving you a lot more choices to use for software replication. Now, in terms of choices, recommendations, I don't think there's any need to use RDMs at all with this kind of environment. I think VMFS is just fine. It's going to be most flexible, easy to manage, and it's going to give you all the performance and everything that you need. The other recommendation is, think about consistency groups. I think where some of these, the one feature I find that's really important that not all these guys have is the consistency groups. If you want to keep 3 different VMs consistent across 2 different ESX servers, not all the products could do that. So if that's important to you, I'd put that in your RFPs if you're drawing any of those up. So going from replication onto workflow. Generally, I find that the commercial enterprises, they have an operations team. That entire operations team has access to the DR site, but still you want to use the virtual center permissions as much as you can. The requirements, the dependency tracking isn't so big that people are thinking having a third-party tool, but you really do want to write it down in advance and leverage that during your DR testing. You know, have an operations manual. And again, the plug, shameless plug for DRS. I think, you know, get rid of the placement question. Testing, again, you know, at least twice a year, surprise tests are something to think about. I find most people in the commercial space don't really consider moving the production workload over to the DR side. I find most of them just have test clients and test networks and try to simulate production work. And that works just fine pretty much for most of them. Now, when we go to the SMB, you see a lot of outsourcing, which is, again, not to say that the other two segments don't outsource, but with SMB, it's more the rule. And when they're outsourcing, again, a lot of the reason they're doing it is because they don't have the network, they don't have the array replication, so they're going to tape. Tape's not my favorite thing in the world. No offense to anybody who works at a tape company. If you're going to use tape, I really recommend you use something that's integrated with VMware Consolidated Backup. Here's six examples of people that are integrated with the VMware Consolidated Backup. The advantages of this are that you're going to have lower overhead on the production ESX servers. You're going to be able to use a wider array of tape hardware and tape changers, and you're going to simplify your management by eliminating agents and whatnot. So that's really the big recommendation is to use VCD if you're going to use tape. Second recommendation is do image-based backups periodically. File-based backups are great if you can do file-based restores, like if you delete a file or whatnot, but if you don't do an image-based backup, you basically wind up having to go through this whole bootstrap process of load an OS, install the backup agent, restore all the files one at a time, and then kind of pray that you don't have some weird incompatibility between the vanilla OS and what was on the system that you backed up file by file. Do an image backup. It's going to make your life a lot easier. Even if it's coming from tape, it's one file to restore, and then again, just power it on. And maybe do incremental restores on top of that afterwards. Now, when working with a hosting provider, I found this isn't a monolithic thing. Not all hosting offerings are the same, even within a single provider. I found, to generalize, I've seen about three different levels. One, you're installing an ESX server at the DR site yourself when you get there. Second level is maybe they'll install the ESX server for you and save you some time, particularly if there's a lot of them. But you've still got to restore your virtual machines. The third level is they've got an ESX server set up, they're ready to take your tapes or your replication and start doing restores on their own because they're very ESX savvy. And when you contract with an outsourcing provider, you're going to choose one type of disaster recovery workflow, one of those three levels. In terms of the workflow, I don't really have a lot of hard and fast guidelines here because, again, since it does depend on what you contracted, it depends on whether the servers are there when you get there, depends on whether you buy, some up front and maybe some later. There's a lot of different options that people have there. With tests, I find that surprise is not an option. You generally have to contract, you have to call up the provider and say, hey, I want to do my test this week and negotiate a window, make sure that there's going to be hardware there. I've also found that people, when they do outsourcing, even though it's possible to do a full test, I find people tend to do partial tests to save money. Now, in terms of who we work with, the people that we're trying to build up the VMware awareness with, I've listed nine DR hosters up there, and we work with all of them and happy with all of them. But the last thing I'd mention is I've noticed some of our resellers are getting kind of aggressive about this since they're already VMware experts. And since all they need is like an FTP server to collect images from, someone just copying the images over, they're like, hey, I could make a DR colo, for my smaller customers that, and that actually works. There's some companies making pretty good little business off of doing DR hosting for their regional customers. And so you may want to consider, looking at your VARs or your VACs and seeing if any of them are doing it. But whoever you work with, encourage them to do more VR offerings. Encourage them to get more VR savvy. Have VCPs on site to help you out. Because while alliances are great and all of these are working well, I wouldn't have listed them if I didn't think they're working well, there's nothing like customer engagement to make things move faster. Last thing that's, this doesn't fit into the enterprise commercial SMB thing, but retail and branch offices. Everybody can have retail and branch. And that's kind of a tricky one, because the assumption is, oh, of course I'm going to back up all my branch offices, right? But sometimes the things in your branches, you don't really have real data there. Sometimes the data, like a point of sale on a retail office, might be going directly to the home office. It may never actually sit persistently at the site, so maybe you don't have to do DR for it. Maybe it's a manufacturing facility where you have really, really important information, like the configurations for all the machines, but in a disaster, well, machine's gone, configuration isn't very useful. Now, if you've disqualified all those branches, and it turns out you do have some branches that have very important data that is local and needs to be DR, you've got a couple choices. You could do tape or host-based replication. You're generally not going to do array-based replication from 100 different branches. I've not run into that yet. You know, we recommend you get to the host-based replication if you can. If you can't, you know, tape's great, and refer to the tape recommendations before. But one of the things I've started to notice, growing software space is in data deduplication and WAN optimization. Maybe you can consider buying that bandwidth that you couldn't buy, because now you can do more with less bandwidth. If you're using a Riverbed or a Cisco to accelerate the WAN traffic, or an Avermar or a data domain to deduplicate the traffic, so you're just sending less information. These are things that I think, you know, people should consider for branches. And of course, you know, the difference between, you know, tape and host base, you know, the host base would be far less management difficulty for the people there, because they don't have to go swapping tapes and clear, you know, tape jams and whatnot. But then it could be more expensive, because you've got to buy the bandwidth and replication software. So you have this cost versus complexity issue that you do have to resolve for yourself. So any questions on use cases by deployment type before I go into the miscellaneous considerations? Wow, really quiet this year. Sure, question.
I do have a question.
So the question was, can you do image level backups and file level restores through VCB? So the answer is sort of. The VCB is not itself a backup product. VCB does not do restores. The integrated backup software, you know, the six companies I listed, do the restores. So you can have them back up the images, and you can have them restore the images. Then what you can do is, it's the proxy. You can then mount those using command line and get a window and actually browse through those and pull individual files out manually and put those back to the virtual machine. So you don't have to clobber the entire virtual machine with the image. You can restore the whole thing to a temporary location and then pick out the pieces. Does that answer your question? Yes, you could also restore the whole thing, boot it, and pull the files off. Sure. Either way, you are stuck restoring the whole thing. And so this is something that I think is an interesting place for development between VMware and our backup partners. And again, I think you should pressure VMware and the backup partners both to get this together, is to have the backup vendors be able to read the image, parse through the images on tape and pull things out of it. A lot of people, I think they call them full synthetic backups, is technologies that these backup vendors are starting to invest in, and to have them work with, our image as a full that they can parse and read off a tape and pull pieces out, I think that's a great idea, and it's certainly within the realm of technical possibility. It's just a matter of getting those integrations done. The VMware virtual disk format is an open format. We give that away freely. There's no licensing terms, no restrictions, so anybody can do that wants to. So that's a good question. And again, if it's a real concern for you, pressure us, pressure your backup vendor, and I think it's something that you'll probably see over time. Question in the back? I don't have the numbers, and if I did, I probably wouldn't want to, you'd be pitching other people's products, and I don't want to, hype one over the other. I'm sure there are differences between them. I just kind of know, what their function is, and their function is to, deploy things like, data deduplication and TCP window increasing and local caching to make sure that you're sending the least amount of data with the most possible compression with the least possible latency on the packets. And when you do that, you can make much better use of a smaller amount of bandwidth. Your results are going to vary based on on the characterization of the data, the applications that are running on it. The point of this presentation isn't so much to, to push one specific solution, but to make you aware of the options. And I'd encourage you to talk to these vendors, and find out what their VMware story is, find out if they've done any of these tests, and how it helps you. So the question was, will a WAN accelerator help if the image is already compressed? And the answer is yes. You can compress lots of files, and they can all compress to you something very similar, but then you have to send each file separately, and you're resending the same compressed data over and over again. But something that has caching and is only sending a tag instead of the changed block, that's gonna decrease the amount of data going over the wire. By 1 over n, depending on n virtual machines. And because a lot of the virtual machine data is OS information that's identical across your VMs, I think that is actually somewhere that people can gain benefit. Again, I'm not going to promise a specific number, but I've heard that it's worked pretty well from various customers. So I'll move on to miscellaneous considerations. And by miscellaneous, I don't mean unimportant. I mean that there was just no good way to categorize them. So doing DR is different based on different types of applications. Every application is different and maybe has different considerations. I'm not going to read the entire eye chart to you. That would be kind of boring. I'm just going to pick out a couple of ones that I think are kind of interesting. For CPU and I/O load, I've pitched DRS for placement a couple of times, but think about the specific DRS features. When you're looking at a multi-tier application, you may want to use the affinity rules to say databases and application servers should be on the same host so that they take advantage of the low-level latency on the virtual switch when it doesn't go out over the wire. Let's say you have four web servers fronting that multi-tier application. You want to use the anti-affinity rules so that they spread out across different hosts in the DR site. The last thing you need is to randomly power them all on into the same system and have a single point of failure within your DR site. So affinity and anti-affinity rules, I think, are pretty interesting in the multi-tier application. We talked about consistency groups before for multi-tier applications. Highly recommended. Whatever replication system you use, you should try to figure out how to work consistency groups together. In terms of quiescing, this I'd point to the enterprise applications. Like let's say you have an Oracle database that's front-ending your entire business. Well, you probably want to have that quiesce to make sure that you have at least one known good point in time that you can roll back to if crash consistent happens to not be good enough. And that leads to specific technical recommendations like maybe using RDMs in conjunction with your replication provider. Clustering is an interesting one. Some applications, they tell you don't bother with DR. Just do an active-active load balance across multiple sites, split the writes and have everything nicely mirrored between the two. And then when one site dies, the other site just keeps going, albeit with fewer servers serving the traffic. If you do that, that's going to make DR much, much simpler. But it's generally on an application-by-application basis as opposed to, say, the stuff I've been talking about with VMware, that's a general purpose solution. Replicate the VM, leverage hardware independence and power it on in kind of an active passive mode. But I find a lot of, for really business critical things, you may want to consider going outside that general purpose solution I described and go to an application specific one. In terms of startup order, this goes back to the dependency things I was talking about, right? Make sure your infrastructure comes up first, make sure the things that run your business come up next. And with multi-tier applications, make sure the tiers start up in the right order. And that may not be obvious just from looking at a list of VMs, so it's the kind of thing that helps to have written down or scripted. Changing IP address and domains. This is sometimes very easy depending on the application or very difficult. Make sure you think about that for all your critical workloads. Licensing can be an issue. Every ISV licenses differently in the context of virtualization. There isn't really a standard for this. Make sure that you know whether or not you have to pay for a powered off copy. Make sure you know if there's a difference between moving from a 2 CPU system at the production site to a 4 CPU system on a DR site. These are things that you want to check out with your ISVs. Lastly, think about your legacy applications. You know, before your COBOL programmer retires to his condo in Florida, make sure you know how that application is going to behave. There's a lot of things where VMware helps you by virtue of just being VMware. Legacy applications tend to like legacy operating systems. Legacy operating systems tend to like legacy hardware. Virtual machine hardware is much simpler and will support NT4.0 a lot better than, say, your brand new Blade, chassis, right? So we can run older and older legacy applications. But some of these in-house applications are sensitive to hostname changes, sensitive to IP changes. Sometimes things are hard-coded in there. Make sure you test that out. Make sure you investigate that. Network considerations. This is kind of a juicy topic, and I'm not a networking expert, so I don't have a tremendous amount to say about this, but I've kind of surveyed customers and found that there's different approaches to this. How do you handle IPs at the DR site when you come up? Well, my favorite way to do this, and some customers are doing this, is to just bridge the IP ranges across multiple sites. This is, I think, difficult on the networking team, but it's very easy on the server team because nobody has to change an IP address, DNS stays the same, life's great. Next best thing is VLAN transfer. You can have a VLAN at the production site, and then when that production site goes away, kind of migrate that VLAN over to the DR site, and again, you don't have to change IP addresses or host names or anything like that at the DR site. Some network groups don't want to do even that. So some enterprising server administrators have actually figured out how to use DHCP and dynamic DNS to actually make DHCP work for servers. I spent 4 years in IT. I never thought I'd hear this, but the first time I heard it was from a very large financial in New York, and they say it actually works. It's kind of scary, but it apparently technology is changing. Applications getting more robust in the face of these sorts of changes. Worst-case scenario, which I think a lot of people are in this worst-case scenario, is changing IP addresses of each of your virtual machines. And today, this is kind of a manual process. If you have 100 virtual machines, you're going to go re-IP 100 of them. This is something I think that we'd like to help with. We don't have a product that does it now, but that's something we have to think about for the future as we expand our disaster recovery capabilities. Lastly, whatever you do here, make sure it's reflected in DNS one way or another, whether you're changing it manually, scripting it, doing dynamic DNS, whatever. Obviously, once you change your IPs, everybody's got to find you. So last topic I have here is P2VDR. So everything I've been talking about assumes, what I like to assume, virtual machines at the source side, virtual machines at the destination side. Everything's wonderful. I make a lot of money. But there's a lot of people that say, well, I like virtualization, but I'm not really going to do a big consolidation project until the hardware comes off maintenance, come back in a year and a half. Then find they have to do a DR project, and they go, well, I'm not going to buy all more copies of these physical machines at the DR site. I'm going to do a virtual DR site. How do I get from physical and production to virtual and DR? So there's really two steps to this. The first step is convert your physical machines to virtual machines at the local site. Forget about DR for a second. Just say, well, if this server dies, physical server, I want to be able to have a local copy of that in a VM on site so I can power that up. Now, once you've gone and made virtual copies of all your physical machines, well, DR is really simple. You just follow all the rest of the recommendations we were talking about earlier, right? So it's just virtual to virtual at that point. So physical to virtual DR, in my mind, is an additive sort of thing, not an entirely different sort of thing. Now, how do you do a good P2V? What's the right way to do this? And I find there's kind of a decision tree that you have to make, and there's three different prongs here. I should probably have a graphical representation of it. But you have two decisions to make. The first decision is, let me back up a second here. I think P2V really should be broken down into two different processes. There's an imaging process and a conversion process. Some tools combine this, but they're really doing two things. And they're just making it seamless for you. You can think of it as a seamless transition, or you could do it in two steps, whichever way suits your purposes. But that gets to your decisions, however. You have to decide whether you do want to do imaging one time for an application or you want to do imaging repeatedly over and over again. And there's different reasons to do this. You generally want to do one-time imaging for applications that are pretty static. They don't change. They're on a legacy OS that isn't being patched and getting security fixes all the time. And where maybe you're afraid the application is sensitive and you don't want to install a regular imaging product on it and you're worried about application compatibility. So the one-time imaging products tend to involve downtime, right? You put the CD in the tray, you reboot the system, it sucks the, everything you need to do the imaging is on that CD, it doesn't get loaded on your host, you suck the image off, send it over the network, you take the CD out, reboot the host, and it's just happy, it's totally unmodified and everything's fine. So that's one way to do it for one type of application. Now, for your other applications, the ones that are more modern and are getting updates and security patches and their operating systems are doing the same, you're going to want to do regular imaging. You don't want to have to think about doing an image every single time you do some sort of update. You just want to know that, you know, every night or every week you're getting a good image of the system so that you're ready to go do DR off of it should the need arise. Now, this has a different set of usage. You certainly don't want to do a nightly or a weekly downtime for each system if you're going to be repeatedly imaging it. So you're going to want to have something that fits in the file system to the filter driver thing and is constantly, you know, is able to image from within the box without taking the host down. So these products do exist, you know, things like Semantic Live State and Acronis and stuff like that. You generally want to make sure you have something that has incremental capability. You don't want to image the entire thing every single night and totally saturating your network. Now, what do you do once you have that image? You have to convert it to a VM. And again, two choices here. First, you can convert it every time you do an image. And the advantage of this is that you get a great recovery time objective. You're always going to have a VM ready to go, ready to power up, because it's always everything's converted and ready to go. But now you're doing a whole lot of conversions with, you know, not a lot of reason, because, you know, most nights of your life there's no disaster. The other way to go is just, you know, convert the image at disaster recovery time. So you have the images sitting there in a store just waiting for the disaster. Disaster happens, you convert them, and then power them on. So a longer recovery time, but a simpler process with less redundant work. I would think conversion would break more often. I mean, imaging is a pretty so imaging will break imaging will break when you don't have the right drivers in this imaging tool for the particular host. Now, that's generally solved with the continuous imaging tools because they're using the host's own drivers. So it's really the one-time imaging that will break on imaging if you don't have the right driver, but then you just get the driver, install it, and you'll be fine. Right, and that's for the conversion side, and that will break from time to time if you got some really weird hardware, and maybe your conversion provider was VMware or somewhere else, maybe you'll have to open a support ticket. But this is why, again, we go back to continuous DR testing. You really want to make sure that that you're testing this, that you don't just, you know, do a P2V and then file it away and, you know, hope for the best. When the disaster comes, you want to try it out. Most of the time, I mean, a lot of the tools here, they'll work most of the time, but every now and then, sure, you'll get an outlier that's not going to work. So, I mean, the only thing I can tell you is test it and report bugs and make sure that your vendors with VMware or someone else are responsive to it. Speaking of other vendors, I broke my alphabetical order rule on this slide. Can anybody guess why? I could have done it reverse. That might have been dishonest in its appearance of impartiality. VMware has got a VMware Converter, which is going into beta. It's in beta right now, coming out, you know, whenever the beta's over. I encourage you to try that. It will be replacing VMware Importer and P2V Assistant, giving you the best benefits of both. And we're really proud of this product. It's been in development for a while. We think it's going to do a great job. That said, we have a lot of other partners doing imaging and conversion. Cronus, HP, LeoStream, Platespin, Symantec. And you will get great support from VMware if you're using those tools also. In the end of the day, any tool you use that creates VMware virtual machines is fine by us. You know, so we will try to sell our tool, but if you're using the other ones, you know, that's great too. So I did want to, you know, put in a plug for all those partners out there as well as our own. And that is the last content slide. Thanks for sticking with it. I know it's late and everybody's tired, but I will hang around for questions. We have another 10 minutes and I got nowhere to go. So, ask questions, anything you'd like. Question over there? So the question was, how does Virtual Center handle a two-site DR? Because I talked about vMotion and DRS and resource pools, and you need Virtual Center there, right? People can try to do it one of two ways. You can try to have one Virtual Center control both sites, and when a disaster happens, recover Virtual Center to their side. That's one possibility. And the biggest difficulty on that is handling the database. Virtual Center is stateless, you know, pretty easy to install application. What most people do with DR sites, though, or when they have multiple sites, is have Virtual Center on site 1, Virtual Center on site 2, and they just replicate stuff over. And instead of replicating Virtual Center, they'll register the replicated VMs into Virtual Center and then leverage that VC instead of trying to recover the whole database. Yeah, today it's a manual process. It's something, again, you know, we'd like to do a better job of enabling. Again, we think that virtual machines are awesome for disaster recovery over physical machines, but we haven't eliminated every last manual step yet. And so that's examples of some of the ones that you would have to take. Question? Generally. You don't want to... Sure. So basically the point was that, you know, these manual steps that I described before should not be there. A disaster, you could be lose people, you might not have the experts there, and Virtual Center should just replicate itself. And I think that's a very fair point. We do need to do advancements in Virtual Center, Virtual Center's availability itself, because it's becoming a critical part of the virtual infrastructure. You know, fortunately, I don't have product to announce here, but you know, we are constantly working on this sort of thing, and so I'm just giving the best practices that we've got with what's out there. But I would encourage, you know, people, if they're really interested in the future and if there's a particular feature they need, you know, talk to your sales team. You know, try to get an NDA roadmap on where we're going in the future, because we do have plans. Other question in the back. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question. Unfortunately, that's not my purview. But I would pass that on to your sales team and make your expectations known. Any other questions? Oh, come on, I'll be more polite with the next one, I promise. Okay, fine. Well, thank you very much, everyone.